To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod.
Welcome to the Death Panel. Patrons, thank you so much for supporting the show. We are entirely listener-supported and couldn't do any of this without you. If you'd like to help us out a little bit more, you can always share the show with your friends, hold listening or discussion groups, or post about your favorite episodes, pick up copies of Health Communism and A Short History of Trans Misogyny at your local bookstore or request them at your local library, and follow us at deathpanel_. I'm Beatrice Adler-Bolton, and today I am joined by two of my co-hosts, Artie Vierkant.
Hello.
And Jules Gill-Peterson.
Hello.
And the three of us today are going to be doing a close read on a recent piece that was published March 11th by NPR called Wrestling with My Husband's Fear of Getting COVID Again. Now, a lot of people rightly got very mad when this piece came out. It was thoroughly critiqued online, calling the piece out for its pathologization of those who still take layered COVID protection seriously. The way that, for example, the author put her husband's desire for COVID precautions stemming from his being immunocompromised on the same level as her desire to go out to eat in restaurants. There's a lot there. It's a very short piece. And there are a couple reasons why we wanted to talk about it today, especially, yes, all of what I just mentioned, but also there's a huge point that this piece is trying to make about so-called risk assessments, and the privatization of care in the family. And so, you know, even the way that the conflict is framed in the piece, the framing that, again, you know, folks very rightly called out right away when it was published, is, as you put it when we were texting about this, Jules, quote, a very juicy example of a much bigger issue. So we're going to do a close read of this piece. It's very short. I think we will need to spend a lot of time discussing not just what is being said in the piece, but what is going unsaid in this piece.
Especially, yeah.
Yeah. So there's so much going on here, but before we start with the close read, is there anything either of you want to just offer up in terms of opening thoughts or any additional context on this piece that we should get into first?
Yeah, I think one thing that this piece kind of helped me start to think about a little more directly is some of the actual ways sociologically or relationally that privatizing care and turning COVID into a risk vector, like how does that actually get socialized in real life? You know, it's through relationships, it's through kinship structures, it's through forms of attachment that are both, you know, affectional but also economic, like the couple form. And I mean, it's not like I didn't know that, but there's just something about reading this that kind of made it click into place for me, like, oh, right, this is like an experience vector for so many people. How do you actually experience state abandonment, right, of the collective population, or, you know, the abandonment of all measures to take care of one another collectively? You experience it through these private relationships.
I think I had kind of a similar experience, which was my first experience of it was sort of, I skimmed the piece. I got to the part that we'll talk about a little bit later, which is where they make the hard pivot towards so-and-so medical professional says this may just be anxiety getting wrapped up in the husband's continued desire for not getting COVID and not having the material impacts on his life and the author's life too, frankly, that comes with. And my initial reaction was like, oh, wow, here it is, the thing that we've been calling out as the thing that's been the subtext of so many things in the drumbeat for years and years at this point. And that's all true. But then it's very interesting because then as I sort of read and reread the piece again, these other layers that you're talking about, Jules, started to come to the surface, which is, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think another way to say sort of what you just said is all of the stuff that we're about to talk about today, you know, everything that is written here in this piece was prefigured by the disastrous set of policy decisions to create a sociological end to the pandemic.
Yes.
Rather than an epidemiological end to the pandemic or whatever else that we could call actually making it truly not a big deal or eradicated or, you know, whatever could have been the option.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we really have here is kind of one of those like classic examples of having two solutions to understanding and interpreting conflict, right? Does this have anything to do with, for example, a collective response to the pandemic that has been retracted in favor of a personal response, right? There is literally a line in this piece that says long COVID is a family problem that we'll get into, right? Or is this merely an issue happening between two private parties, two people, and therefore a kind of marital negotiation, right? So there is, you know, I think a really good example of, as you're saying, Artie, something that we often allude to, we discuss as part of the pandemic minimization sort of arsenal. And this is very literally one of those examples of how stigma doesn't just pop up out of the ground like a dandelion or something, right? It needs to be made, created, reinforced, and reproduced. And this is a really good example of not just like a bad piece, but a piece that literally invites intensification and reproduction of the very issue it's purporting to try to solve its very structure. And so there's a bit of a sort of mindfuck aspect to, you know, the kind of way that the experts and the professionals, speak, engage with these questions, right? But it really points to something that we talk about all the time, which is that the kind of language that we use to talk about the pandemic, it matters to be precise because that's part of how these kinds of pressures and realities are actually literally enforced in a very specific and iterative social context.
Yeah. And if I may, a final thing before we sort of jump in, I think to your point, there are fundamentally two different things going on in this article simultaneously. And I think both of them are, you know, bad ultimately. I think both of them we will have disagreements with, but I think that there are two separate things just to keep in mind as we go through here. I think the first is the attempt the author is making to be empathetic. I say attempt very specifically, right? The attempt to be empathetic that the author clearly really wants to convey. She cares about her husband. She's signaling that she cares about COVID somewhat, doesn't care that much maybe, and is clearly more than a little tired of it. But there's a lot of language, even including, we'll see at the very beginning, you know, mentioning government abandonment, sort of, not exactly by name, but, you know, mentioning or kind of throwing to government abandonment, throwing to the fact that long COVID is serious, throwing to the fact that the husband's concerns are valid. But then, you know, it quickly turns to valid up until a point. There's a second thing going on, though, beyond the interpersonal stuff that then shapes, I think, that first interpersonal lens. The second part, though, is more the professional advice that she is getting, for lack of a better way to put it, right? The medical advice and often outright pathologization that she's getting from the professionals that she chose to speak to for this piece. I think it's notable that we don't get a professional in here who is saying, yeah, your husband's right.
Yeah. Should we get into the close read from here right away?
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so as B mentioned at the top, this is a piece that ran March 11th in NPR. The author's name is Malaka Gharib, and it is called Wrestling with My Husband's Fear of Getting COVID Again. And I think we're probably going to close read most of this, I would say. The beginning part, though, is really important. So we're going to get, I'll just telegraph what's going to happen, basically. We're going to get all that stuff that I talked about just a moment ago, which is, this is the big empathy part. So it begins. In 2022, while I was 7 months pregnant, my husband and I got COVID. While it was a mild case for me, he had scary, lingering symptoms. He said it felt like there was an engine humming in his chest. He experienced frightening fits of insomnia, and his personality changed. My normally upbeat husband became uncharacteristically depressed. After a few months, his symptoms went away, but his fears of getting COVID didn't. He is immunocompromised, and his doctors warned him that if he got sick again, it may complicate his autoimmune disease. Plus, he didn't want to repeat his traumatic ordeal, especially with a baby on the way. There are more reasons to be anxious. State and national measures to prevent COVID are falling away, like most recently the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's decision to end its 5-day isolation guidance. And the disease is still very much a threat. Yes, vaccines and boosters can protect against severe illness, but vulnerable people like my husband are still at high risk. To top it off, there is a lot we don't know about the coronavirus. emerging evidence suggests that the neurological symptoms of COVID can persist years after infection. So while the rest of the world seems to have moved on from the pandemic, in our house, it is still 2020. We wear masks when we go into public indoor spaces. We don't eat inside restaurants. We don't go to movies. We have people take COVID tests before they enter our house. All this leaves me feeling torn between two emotions. I want to keep my husband safe and healthy, but I also want our old life back.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just
remarkably honest.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm like, I wish you would name exactly what those two emotions are, but I kind of prefer that she doesn't in some ways. You know, this is kind of what I was referring to in terms of the real balancing of these two sides, so to speak, right? And this is, I think, one of the most core dynamics, like when we're talking about what is difficult and dangerous about the pathologization of people who still protect themselves from COVID. It's not to say that, like, to be pathologized, right, and labeled as mentally ill is bad because mentally ill people are bad, right? No, we're saying, like, in the pathologization of groups of people who are still protecting themselves from COVID, right, we see, for example, the ammunition to equate it with, you know, a preference about social life, right, where you can have the kind of medical need put on the same footing as, you know, someone wanting to go back to restaurants, back to movies, right? The desire to go back to normal becomes like just as equal as the medical need and the medical vulnerability through the leveraging of the framework of anxiety, right? So we're talking about literally how these things are weaponized, not a value judgment saying, you know, like, okay, because this is being equated with mental illness, therefore it's bad. But what I think materially we're also seeing here, you know, as already saying, is this kind of foregrounding of empathy. And I think, as you'll see, as we get into the sections where the experts begin to weigh in, you know, this is also a way of sort of indirectly being like, well, I'm not saying that, you know, I'm saying these things. I'm saying that this is just the way I feel. I can't help the way I feel. And here are these experts and professionals who are here to validate my position, right? So it's a kind of, you know, way of setting up a sense of neutrality, a sense of even-handedness, right? Even though the perspective that we're going to get, as already mentioned, is either all directly and intentionally weighted against the person still taking COVID protections. Anything that comes off also slightly neutral towards the person still taking COVID protections is then interpreted by the author immediately afterward as being favorable towards her position as well. So it's a very kind of insidious way of framing this as a reasonable, even-handed debate where both sides have the same leverage of power. And what's not being named is the kind of massive imbalance of power that exists beyond in the broader context and the like actual social world in which this interpersonal conflict is actually taking place.
Yeah, that's so well said. And it's, I don't want to be overly interpretive about the text in part because this is an article that trades so much in psychotherapeutic interpretation. However, I just want to stress and even underlines part of what you're saying, B, because I think it's so helpful as a guide for understanding what this piece is doing, that empathy, right, is the sort of container in which we get to do this thing that I think, I don't know, I'm just connecting this to so many of the op-eds or other media pieces that we close read on Death Panel. It's very often this style where at the top, through the lens of empathy, you actually dump a bunch of, you know, of useful information, right? Just kind of go through all of the facts that on surface appearance wouldn't actually support, you know, pathologizing someone who doesn't want to get COVID. But part of the reason to dangle that all up front, right, is to then be able to dismiss it really carefully and to begin to assert, in this case, right, that what's really at hand is a battle of emotions, a battle between empathy and something that is perhaps selfish, but you just can't help it. And that is very different, right, than kind of trying to critically analyze the information we have to make decisions, you know, both at the individual level, but of course, at the policy level or at the level of public health or at the level of healthcare, at the level of politics, right, ultimately. And it's just sort of interesting too, that ultimately the way the feeling emerges for the author, right, I think it's really helpful for identifying a larger phenomena that I'm sure lots of people are experiencing different versions of or are encountering in relationships with other people. Just this feeling of, well, everyone else is back to an old life and a pre-2020 life, and I am not. I mean, I just think that's a really, just talk about the sociological production of feelings. I mean, that's a really, that's a really, really intense feeling to have produced politically, intentionally. Absolutely. And propagate it throughout the population. And now people are genuinely caught up in this feeling. And that's, I don't know, I'm just kind of marveling at that for a moment. I mean, it's rare that government can produce such concrete feelings and disperse them so effectively.
That was so well put, Jules. And I feel like one other thing that we're also seeing here is that in terms of other persuasive techniques that are being leveraged against the reader, right? There's also what appears to be kind of like an empathy towards immunocompromised people and their desire to be loved and partnered, right? And yes, that was something that people really reacted strongly to, right? Because that sense of empathy, right, it reads like the kind of betrayal and distrust that I think many people have experienced, where they have begun relationships or had optimism about relationships that could have worked out, you know, but that were ended as a result of difference in levels of taking the pandemic seriously, right? So, you know, I think that there's another layer here too, in just sort of persuasive technique of like, you know, this kind of projection, right, of, well, you've got to kind of compromise here on your COVID protections, like if you want to be loved. And that's really, I mean, I think a pretty insidious undercurrent that runs through the whole piece.
Yeah.
Can't spell immunocompromise without compromise. Sorry.
I was going to.
Saddest joke I've ever thought of. It actually makes me feel terrible.
I love it and I hate it.
To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod. You'll get access to this and the rest of our catalog of patron-only episodes, and be the first to get a new patron episode every Monday when it drops. With love, the Death Panel.